I noted a positive energy as soon as I came in here today, and it's a great pleasure to take part in this seminar, this program. Ultimately, Torah is best taught by personality. We can read everything in books, but ultimately it's the people who embody what you see in those books that have the greatest influence on you. You can have all the Sforim in the world, you can have a Sforim library, you can read them, but what will have the strongest influence on your character is the inspiration of people who live by those books, who embody the character traits, the midos, the greatness that Torah and the Masorah have passed on to us. So I think it really is a great idea to have a biography series, because ultimately, I mean, the people in my life who've been the strongest influence have been people, not books. And therefore, we should take advantage of getting to know as many great people as we can. And that ultimately will make us more interested in the books, to live what it says in the books. But it's the people and not the books that ultimately inspire us. I have to start with a little bit of a disclaimer. But it's not only a disclaimer. I never met Rav Moshe Feinstein. I remember when he was alive, but I never met him. In that, we have something in common. You never met him either. On the one hand, one cannot really speak about someone whom he never met. On the other hand, as Rabbi Simkovich said, I don't know if I can say I know the Igros Moshe backwards and forwards, but Rabbi Simkovich did say correctly that no day goes by that I don't feel in contact with Rav Moshe Feinstein, among other Gedolei Yisrael, but he's had a profound influence on my life. So at some level, I think it's perhaps more appropriate that someone like me speaks to you, because we're in the same boat. We never met him, but he's had a profound influence on my life, and he can have a profound influence on yours too. As I'll say, Ein osin nefoshes l'tzadikim, we don't make real memorials of tzadikim, divrayim heimem zechronim, that's their words that are the memorial. Their words live on longer than any monument or any stone, and that's exactly what I'd like to convey today. When we speak of great personalities, it's almost trite, it's an oft-cited problem that we tell historical facts that are so beyond us that sometimes they're not inspiring, they're discouraging. If I will rattle off for you the ages at which Moshe Feinstein knew Seder Noshim and Nezikin, all of Shas and Shulchan Aruch, I will mention some of those facts, but that might not inspire us so much because it makes us feel inadequate, it makes us feel small. But there's a lot that we can take. I prefer the stories and the records of facts that we can take something away from. And there are more of those than there are of the stories that will make us feel lesser. So it's really the latter category that I would like to focus on. And if I would give, I see some of these seminars have sort of a subtitle. I would call this Rav Moshe Feinstein, A Life of Building. And I hope to explain what I mean by that. Rav Moshe Feinstein, A Lifetime of Building. Just a little bit of background, biographical information. Rav Moshe Feinstein was born to his parents, Rav David and Paya Gittel Feinstein. In New York, we say Feinstein. In Philadelphia, I think they say Feinstein. It's all the same. He actually said Feinstein, so you're closer to the truth. Rav David Feinstein, his father, was a descendant of the brother of the Vilna Gaon. There's a classic Musa Sefer called Ma'alos HaTorah. That's by Rabbeinu Avram, the brother of the Vilna Gaon. It's a classic work. Rav David Feinstein was descended from him. Interestingly, somewhere along the line, the family had become somewhat Hasidish. And actually, Rav David grew up in his earlier years, was more of a follower of the Hasidic movement. Interestingly, when the Shidduch was proposed between him and his wife, so his father-in-law-to-be had as one condition, this is a great Bacher, a fine Talmud Chacham, but we are misnagdim. And he's Hasidic, so one condition of the marriage was that he would go and learn in the Volozhiner Yeshiva, which of course was founded by Rav Chaim of Volozhin, the famed disciple of the Vilna Gaon, which was a straight non-Hasidic Yeshiva, and he sort of shed his Hasidus at the time of the Shidduch, which is an interesting historical fact. So Rav Moshe actually at some level did descend from a Hasidus, and you'll see later in his life he had different interactions and David in Hasidus Shtiblach, and he had an affinity for Hasidus, although he himself was what we would call a misnagid or a non-Hasid. Interestingly, and I know later you're going to hear from Rabbi Simkovich about Rav Soloveitchik, Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rav Moshe Feinstein were cousins. And here you have a little bit of the family. And it's confusing because, as very often happens, you have people with the same last name marrying into the same family, so it gets a little bit tricky. But basically, Rav Soloveitchik's mother's mother and Rav Moshe's mother were sisters, if I'm not mistaken. There was a man by the name of Rabbi Eliyahu Feinstein, who was a brother-in-law of Rabbi David Feinstein, that's Rav Moshe's father, but they were not brothers, they were brothers-in-law. Rabbi Eliyahu Feinstein was a Levi, and Rav Moshe's family were non-Levium, so he met basically two people named Feinstein married sisters. So it's a little bit confusing, but this Rabbi Eliyahu Feinstein, who later was known as Ella Prisoner, that's Rav Soloveitchik's grandfather, that's Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's father-in-law. So it's Rav Soloveitchik's grandfather, who was a mechutin with Rav Chaim Brisker. So that is the relationship between Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Soloveitchik. Basically, Rav Soloveitchik was Rav Moshe's first cousin once removed. They had close interaction as Gedolei Yisrael, as leaders of Klal Yisrael, but also they had a familial connection, which made it even stronger. I had a Rebbe in Yeshiva, who when he was himself learning in Yeshiva, used to attend Rav Soloveitchik's shiurim up at YU in Washington Heights, and then he would want to catch Rav Moshe's shiur down on the Lower East Side. So he used to stay almost to the end of Rav Soloveitchik's shiur, and then he'd hop on a train and run downtown and catch Rav Moshe's shiur. Moshe Feinstein used to give shiurim, and if you ever read the Dibros Moshe, which are his Chidushim on Shas, he starts off with a whole list of questions. This is difficult, that's difficult, a whole string of 20 or 30 questions. And then Anach Beis, the second branch of the luminous Dvar Torah, is Hanira Lanias Daiti, and I think, and he'll say a novel idea, and then he'll go back and show how that novel idea answers all of the difficulties, or many of the difficulties. So this Rebbe of mine used to miss the questions. He would come late, but he would hear the answer and the punchline and go back and plug in the answer to the question. So Rav Moshe and Rav Soloveitchik were related that way. Thank you very much. Thank you. Oh, wow. I don't even get to sit home. This is great. interesting story involving Rabbi Elio Feinstein, Rav Moshe's uncle, and Rav Ella Prisoner. Later, when Rav Moshe was about 11, he had already mastered Seder Noshim and Nezikin, one-third of Shas. And when his uncle came to visit, Rav Moshe walked into the room. Rabbi Elio Feinstein was visiting his brother-in-law, Rabbi David Feinstein, and young Rav Moshe Feinstein walked into the room, and Rav Ella Prisoner got up. He said, "For a boy who knows two Siddurim and Shas, we have to stand up." And there was a look in Rav David Feinstein's eye, and he signaled him, step out into the other room, and he closed the door, and Rav Moshe heard it. He heard, he said, "You're trying to kill my son? You're going to give him a swelled head? He's going to become arrogant. Don't you ever do that again." And Rav Moshe said he learned at that moment the importance of anivos, of not being too proud, how seriously his father took the danger, the threat that somebody should compliment him, and he learned a great lesson from that. When I say that Rav Moshe had a lifetime of building, what I really mean is, and this is something we can all take from, every experience in his life was another brick. We experience many things during the course of a day, a week, a year, but we let it go. Something happened, it was interesting, I forget about it. It's in one ear and out the other. Rav Moshe took every single incident, the same way every insight in a Gemara, a Rashi, a Tosus, he recorded, he thought about it until he had it worked out, and he remembered it for all of his life. It was like that with everything in his life. Every incident he had in life, he took very, very seriously. When Rav Moshe was, I guess, 5 or 6 years old, his father brought him to start learning Gemara. He had already learned all of Tanakh. His father learned all of Tanakh with his son, which is not unfathomable. It would be difficult for us, but he had learned all of Tanakh. And he brought him into a group of older boys who had already started to learn Gemara, and there was a Rebbe, and Rav Moshe had not learned Gemara at all, but he knew all of Tanakh. So they opened the Gemara, and the Rebbe said, "Okay, we're on the sixth line, first word on the line. Who can read the word and tell me what it means?" Rav Moshe raised his hand. The word was Itmar. We all know when you learn Gemara, Itmar means we're about to quote something, right? It was said, Itmar. So Rav Moshe opened the Gemara, he looked at the word, he said, Itamar. It's one of the sons of Aaron HaKohen. And the other boys burst out laughing, because they had already learned Gemara, and they knew that this was not correct. And of course, Rebbe shushed them and told them they shouldn't do that. But Rav Moshe used to tell the story for the rest of his life. He said, I learned two things at that moment that stayed with me for the rest of my life. First of all, he learned that it's painful to be laughed at, and he accepted that upon himself and never laughed at anybody. That's an obvious lesson, Bein Adam L'Chavero. But he also said, I learned then that when you're presented with a question, and you know the answer, somebody asks you a question, you know the answer, you are sure, you've learned this, you've mastered this, you knew all of Tanakh, I know the answer. Sometimes, you can be wrong. There's a different plane of viewing things, there's a different realm at which your answer is correct in one area, but it's wrong in a different area. It's right in Tanakh, but it's wrong in Gemara. And he said he began to think about every problem that way. Somebody asks you a Shaila, you know the answer. But maybe in this circumstance, that's not the answer. I always tell the story, a couple years ago, a newly married woman called me up. She said she took a, she had a kashrut shaila. She said, I took a fleishig teaspoon and I stirred a coffee that had milk in it. I said, I don't believe you. What? I said, I don't believe you. I said, I don't believe you have a fleishig teaspoon. You've been married 2 months. I know that every Shabbos you ate at your parents' or your in-laws, you've hardly used your fleishig silverware at all, much less teaspoons. I said, I don't believe you have a fleishig teaspoon. And she said, you know, you're right. I said, the fleishig set doesn't make much difference in halacha, but she doesn't actually have a fleishig teaspoon. But Moshe taught that you have to be able to see beyond the surface. The answer is correct, but it depends if you're viewing it in the right context. Itamar and Itmar are two different words, and it depends what you're studying. Rav Moshe was born in 1895 in the city of Uzda, what was Belarus, and he was born on Zion Adar. Zion Adar, we know, is the birthday of Moshe Rabbeinu, and the fact that he was born on that day is, of course, the reason why he was named Moshe. Even though his bris was on Purim and his father was considering Mordechai, but he named him Moshe because he was born on the 7th of Adar. And Rav Moshe said all of his life that that had a profound impact on his thinking. Rav Moshe had 11 siblings, almost all of whom were killed or died in childhood. He suffered through many, many tragedies, both in his life in Russia and even later when he came to the United States. He had a very hard life. And when he was asked later in life, when he was already a Gadol B'Yisrael who dedicated so much of his time to helping people, and there was no question too small. There was a woman who used to call Rav Moshe when he was a man in his 90s every Friday and ask what time candle lighting is. And every week he would look it up on the calendar and tell her what time candle lighting is. There was no problem too large or too small for him to address. And when he was asked, why do you let people do that to you? Many leaders have, they have a gatekeeper, there's a gabbai, there's someone you have to get past, you can't just go in and talk to him. But Moshe was not very much so. He was much, very, very much approachable. And when asked why he was so giving that way, he said that he had determined that he really was not meant to live, that he should have survived from all of his siblings and all the people, his childhood friends, almost all of them did not survive. He felt his survival was a miracle. And it was only for the purpose of helping others. Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch has a beautiful vart, a beautiful insight on the name Moshe. And Bas Paro draws Moshe Rabbeinu from the water, and she names him Moshe, Kimin Hamayim Mishisihu, because I took him out of the water. So it's interesting, it's really an Egyptian name. Moshe Rabbeinu, the Medrash says he had other names, he had numerous names, but the name that he's called by is Moshe. Moshe, Moshe, HaKadosh Baruch Hu calls him Moshe. Furthermore, the grammar is wrong. Kimin Hamayim Mishisihu, the name should be Moshui, the drawn one. Moshe connotes further drawing. Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch says that Moshe Rabbeinu was to be reminded that everyone else, his age, all the other boys at least, were thrown into the Nile. They didn't survive. He was Kimin Hamayim Mishisihu. He was drawn out. Every time HaKadosh Baruch Hu will call his name, Moshe, you have to go save people. He's being told, you are Moshui, you were drawn out, go be Moshe. Go draw other people out, go save other people. And Moshe Feinstein very much lived with that mindset, that he was saved and his existence was solely for helping other people, which is exactly what he dedicated his life to. When he was young, he had access to great Gadol Yisrael. His father alone was a great Gadol Yisrael. Just to give you an insight of his greatness, Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer, who's another Gadol from Europe, whose name you may have heard, had a yeshiva together with Rav Pesach Pruskin. We have sperm from Rav Pesach Pruskin. He was a Rebbe of Rav Moshe. They had a yeshiva together, and there was a conflict. They had different ideas of how the yeshiva should be run, and they couldn't settle it. And Rav Pesach Pruskin wanted to sort of break away and form a new yeshiva. And Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer felt that that was not right. He could not do that. And they disagreed, and they agreed they would go to a din Torah. They would go have a Rav hear out the case and make a determination for them, as we're supposed to do when we can't agree. Rav David Feinstein, Rav Moshe's father, was selected as the Dayan to rule between these two great Gedolei Yisrael. Interestingly, by the way, he ruled that Rav Pesach Pruskin had the right to form his own yeshiva. Rav Pesach Pruskin forms his own yeshiva, and when they inaugurated the yeshiva, you know who was the guest of honor at the opening event? Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer. He accepted the ruling. That's what the Gemara says when a person has a din Torah. After the ruling is accepted, he's supposed to have no tainas, no claims, not be upset. He accepted it to the degree that, that's it, there's supposed to be another yeshiva. I retract my position, and he was agreeable. These are the lessons that Rav Moshe had early in his life. When he was 5 years old, his father felt that the group of Talmidim with whom he was given to study was too large. He was not going to get sufficient attention, so his father paid out of pocket to split the class, which was something he certainly could not afford. He felt that his son's chinuch, his son's training in Torah, was essential. When Rav Moshe was 9 years old, he finished Seder Nezikin, which is a big task. When he was 11, he had finished Seder Nashim as well. At the age of 16, as recorded by his family, he had finished Shas and Shulchan Aruch. Very impressive. As I said before, he suffered many tragedies in his life, many pogroms. I mean, one cannot count the number of times that he could have been killed, where there was a near miss, where he almost lost his life. He had to flee from the Russian army. Rav Moshe met the Chafetz Chaim as a teenager when he was, he had a temporary exemption from the army, from the Russian army, but he had to go travel to an office to try to get a further exemption. En route, they stopped somewhere where the Chafetz Chaim happened to have been staying in that city, so his father said, let's go meet the Chafetz Chaim. And when they sat down, and the father introduced, he said, this is my son, Moshe Feinstein. Chafetz Chaim said, I've heard of you. I've heard about you. And Rav Moshe said that stayed with him his entire life. He felt elevated by the Chafetz Chaim's words, and the Chafetz Chaim gave him a bracha. The Chafetz Chaim told him, there is a gzeirah min hashamayim that you should be enlisted in the army. However, the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, called Makabel of Ol Torah Ma'avir and Mimenu Ol Malchus, the person who accepts upon himself the yoke of Torah, so the yoke of a regime is lifted from upon him. He said, and the zechus and the merit that you have accepted the yoke of Torah upon yourself, you will get out of this gezeirah. It was very, very difficult. It involved a number of different stops and miracles, but Rav Moshe was spared being in the army. Other tragedies that they experienced, Rav Moshe's wife, Rebbe Tzimtzima, her family name was Kostanovich, was from the city of Luban. They did not know this until many years later. But when the Nazis came to that city, and Rav Moshe and his Rebbetzin had gotten out, but much of the family remained behind, so her father, who was a great Rav, was also the Shochet of the city, as was her brother, father's son. And when the Nazis came to that city, they brought out the Shochet and his son and used the Shechita knife and actually shechted them in front of the entire city and then electrocuted the people in the city. It was a terrible, terrible, horrible tragedy. And these were the experiences of their youth. Rav Moshe did assume the Rabbonus in that city of Luban, and he always said it was a holy city. The Jews there, he said, even the Balagola was a standard expression for a person of low class. He said, even the Balagola, the wagon driver in Luban, was a Bucky and Shas and Poskim, was a great Talmud Chacham. Rav Moshe tells a remarkable story, and I believe this was printed in the Darash Moshe, which is Rav Moshe's Sefer on Chumash, in Parshas Vayera, I think in the second volume. You have to understand, Rav Moshe was not a person to tell incredible stories. So this is particularly striking that he went to visit. There was a balabos, a member of the community in the city of Ruban, who became very ill suddenly. His tongue became very, very swollen, and the doctors couldn't treat it. And Rav Moshe went to visit him, and the man turned to Rav Moshe and he says, "I want to tell you why this happened to me." He said, "Last Friday night, it was Parshas Vayera, and at the table, I said that I didn't understand how the Melech HaMashiach can come from the Benos Lot. The Benos Lot engaged in an act of incest with their father, and named Amon and Moav. Moav is Me'av, from father. They publicized an abominable act by naming their children as being descended from their father. It was an incestuous relationship." And this man sort of mocked him at the table. He says, "I don't understand how David HaMelech and how the Melech HaMashiach can be descended from such people." That's what he said at the Shabbos table. Later that night, he had a dream in which two women, clearly Noshim Chashuvos, holy women, who were Tzinuos, clearly very, very holy people, came to him and they said, "We are the Benos Lot, and we want you to understand that we thought the world was destroyed. Right, when the stone was destroyed, they thought there was no one left in the world. And since we were from the family of Avraham Avinu, people would take us to be holy people, and we were afraid that if we would have children, people would think these are some kind of godly born children, as Christianity later developed such a notion. We were afraid people would think that, so we specifically named them Amon and Me'av to indicate that they were born naturally. These were naturally conceived children. It was not meant to be a Chil Hashem. It was meant to avoid some kind of foreign worship. And since you have spoken ill of us, though, you will be punished." The man told this story to Rav Moshe, and then he rolled over and passed away. And Rav Moshe felt that there was something very real in this story. Fascinating story. It's not every day that one hears a story like that, but Rav Moshe did record the story, and such were the Jews of Ruban. Ultimately, he had to leave when, because of the governmental laws, he felt he did not have chinuch for his children, which is why he set off to ultimately go to the United States. When he first came to Ruban, he was not married, and there was a woman who used to cook for him, and the food was so awful that it was hardly edible. But he ate it anyway because he felt she'd be insulted, so he would just eat it, force himself to eat it. And one time his sister visited him and ate at the same table. When she tasted the food, she said, "How can you eat this?" He said, "I don't like it, but I don't want to insult her, so I eat the food." So when he would tell her the story, he said, "So that time my sister did me a favor. She had like a purse or something with her, so she stuffed the food in the purse and took it out so he wouldn't have to eat it." He said she did him a favor, but such was the tzidkus of the man as well. Ultimately, his wife was from Ruban, and that's where they were married in 1922. They got married actually right after Sfira. Rav Moshe observed mourning very intensely during this period of year that we're in now, the Sfira summer. He observed the entire time, not just 33 days, but the entire time, because many of the pogroms and the tragedies that he experienced took place during Sfira, so he mourned very deeply, and he wouldn't get married during Sfira, but they got married immediately afterwards. In fact, even on the day of their wedding, there was a hardship. Somebody got, they were ready to have the chuppah, and his wife and her father were not there, and it turned out somebody had gotten them in trouble with the authorities. They were in prison. And Moshe had to go down, and she was already in her wedding gown. He had to get her out of, had to bribe the officials there to get out of jail. They were in there for some trumped-up charge. So there was no moment in his life that was without hardship. Ultimately, they came to the United States, I believe, in 1937. Rav Moshe actually first came to Ohio. There was talk and there was an attempt to form a yeshiva. He, together with Rav Ruderman, who was the Rosh Yeshiva in Ner Yisrael, as you may know, and Rav Yehuda Lev Levenberg, who was also one of the founders of Torah education in America, they initially started a yeshiva in Cleveland. Rav Moshe's family was in New York, but he stayed in Cleveland. It didn't last. It didn't work out, and eventually the yeshiva disbanded. But Rav Moshe did settle in New York. Initially, he was supposed to be a dayan. People said, "He has such a gadol who knows how to paskin, knows how to rule on difficult shailos. Let him sit all day, and all the difficult questions will come to him." But Rav Moshe found that the system was so corrupt that it was difficult to survive and continue in that form of work. He, one of his first Dinei Torah, there's a Din Torah between some Rabbonim, and I think some Shochtim or Mashkichim, and he paskened against the Rabbonim. And he said, are you crazy? How can you paskin against Rabbonim? We're on your side. How could you do that? And they became furious at him, and he had another, a few incidents like that where people were upset at the outcome of Dinei Torah and weren't willing to accept it. So he decided this was not going to be his future in New York. Ultimately, he became the Rosh Hashiva of Mesifta Teferes of Yerushalayim. It's known as MTJ. It still exists today on the Lower East Side. His son, Rav David Feinstein, is the Rosh Hashiva now. And lest you think that he had it easy, people leave this picture. You see pictures of Moshe Feinstein's funeral and all the people who were beholding to him, and he must have, as soon as he came to America, been accepted as a Godol B'Yisrael, and everyone had great respect. It was not so. It was not so for any of the Gedolim that you're going to hear about. Rav Moshe started in MTJ. His family lived really in Brooklyn. The yeshiva was in Manhattan. His salary was $7 a week. $7 a week, which was maybe worth a little bit more then, but it was not a great salary by any stretch of the imagination. It did not pay for the fare for him to go back and forth from his home to the yeshiva, so he slept in the yeshiva. He slept on the benches in the Beis Medrash, and he washed himself in the public bathroom in the yeshiva in MTJ. That was his beginnings in New York. It was not easy. In war-torn Europe, he sought very much to help. He tried to get his family out. He tried to help with much of the other Hatzalah efforts, with Gedolei Yisrael going to Washington and pleading for mercy that they should intervene in Europe, you know, with limited success, but that was something that took up a lot of his time and energies, of course. He was in Eretz Yisrael only once. But Moshe Feinstein was in Eretz Yisrael in 1964, and there was so much tirda, so many people that wanted to see him and speak to him, that it was overwhelming that he couldn't stay there. And he never ended up actually traveling back to Eretz Yisrael, much to his chagrin. Interesting story, when Rav Moshe was seeking to avoid the draft, there were papers that were forged that presented him as being older than he was. If he was over 30, he could have avoided certain potential for the draft. So there were documents that made him older than he was. So when he came to the United States, somehow those documents became the point of departure for all of his future records. So he was on record as being older than he was. So there was some point where he somehow started to get some kind of benefit, I don't know, Social Security or some check he actually started receiving earlier than he should have. And he would always send it back, and they didn't even have a system for returns. Nobody ever returns a check. That's a rule in life. People don't return checks that are made out to them. They didn't even have a system, so they would send it back, and he would send it back, and they would send it back, and this went on for a long time. But Rav Moshe would not take what was not truly owed to him, what was not coming to him. Rav Moshe's derech, his approach in psak, and ruling in halacha, was a fascinating one. Rav David Cohn, who's a posik from Brooklyn today and is a great thinker, has an essay where he starts off with the line, Lo hare ha posik hare ha rosh yeshiva. A posik, a person who makes halachic rulings, and a rosh yeshiva are two different types of personalities, two different types really of learning. And this is something that it's good for you to understand. A rosh yeshiva, when you study Gemara, when you try to understand, plumb the depths of the Talmud, so you have a question, and you come up with different answers. Maybe it's like this, maybe it's like that. I have a novel interpretation. I think I can prove that the true understanding is this way or that way or the other way. It's endless. Many great Rosh Yeshiva never wanted to paskin a shayla. They never wanted to rule on a halacha because it's an endless task. Well, you could say it's like that, but if you follow the Meiri, it would really come out like this, and then it's like that. Try to ask a lamdan a shayla. Rabbi, can I do this or not? Well, it never ends because the Gemara never ends. There's no end to the logic and the possibilities. You know, people know the Briskers, their Berach and Tzach was very difficult because it was a never-ending task. A posik, the word posik really means to cut, seek, to interrupt, to draw a bottom line. A posik is somebody who takes from all the complicated sources, the Gemara and the Poskim, and says, but this is what we do, and that's it. A posik has to have a much more cut-and-dry approach. And usually we find people falling into one of two camps, and they don't overlap. either somebody has the creative, constantly flowing and developing system of thought, or a person is much more rigid. There's these three shitas, we follow this one, the minhag is like this, therefore that's the halacha, boom, that's a posek. Usually there are two distinct roles, and you'll find, therefore, that poskim, most poskim are very different from Rosh Yeshiva, Lamdonim. Not that there's no overlap, but usually it's a somewhat different role. For instance, to take an example, if you look at the psukim of Rav Avadya Yosef, one of the great poskim alive today, a great Sephardic leader, so he has a mind like a supercomputer, and he'll give you the background of the Gemara and the Rishonim, and then he'll cite you in the last 300 years all the people who have ruled on this question and give you the gist of where their sentiments lie. That's a posek. What's most interesting about Rav Moshe Feinstein's psukim is that it's like a shir in the yeshiva that comes out with a bottom line of halacha. Very often you're learning Gemara and you'll give a chabur or somebody will present an idea. I have a new interpretation of this Gemara based on a certain question and a certain proof. Here's a new interpretation. But you'll ask me, would I pass in a Shiloh based on that? I wouldn't do that. We don't have the broad shoulders to say just because I have a novel interpretation that means that that's halacha l'maisa. Maybe I'm missing something. All the earlier poskim didn't see it that way. I wouldn't take the responsibility on myself to say that that's in fact halacha. What's so interesting about Rav Moshe's tshuvos is that he'll take you right to the Gemara. He'll say, let's analyze the Gemara. If you learn it like this, it would come out like that. But if you learn it like this, then you get a different conclusion. I'll prove to you it's like that. And I'll go right from the source, something you could give as a shear, and I'll come up with the bottom line. Very often he's willing to challenge Gedolei HaAchronim. If he feels strongly that he's correct, he'll, despite his great humility, when it comes to Psak Halacha, Rav Moshe was very willing, he was very, very confident in his Psakim. A Rebbe of mine, who was a Talmud of his, told us that one time Rav Moshe said a shir, and he came to a certain conclusion, and afterwards one of the Talmidim showed him, they said, Rebbe, look, Rebbe Kiva Eger says not like you. And Rav Moshe says, yeah, I know that. When I get to the Elam Emes, I'll show him I'm right. Which is a very, this is the same person who would humble himself before a child and was the master, Ish Moshe, Anav Ma'od Mikol Adam Hashal Pnei Adam. He was very, very humble. But in Psak Halacha, he felt if he had analyzed the Sugya properly and thoroughly and with Yerush Shemayim, his conclusions would be correct. And that's a very interesting dichotomy, the confidence versus the humility. It's not a contradiction. A person can be very, very confident, but be very, very humble at the same time. He was humble. This same Rebbe of mine told us that one time in Rav Moshe's later years, they came in the morning, and they saw he had a long face on. The Rebbe looked depressed. Rav Moshe was very sad. He said, Rebbe, what's the matter? He said, you know, my heart is weak, and the doctors told me I can no longer wake up at 3 a.m. Usually he would get up very, very early in the morning because that's when he would actually learn. The rest of the day people would be bothering him with questions and shilas and problems. So the rest of his day, once people were awake, he was busy. But he would get up very early in the morning. That's when he had quiet time to learn for himself. So he was upset. He said, the doctors told me I can't wake up at 3 a.m. You know, now I have to wake up at 5 a.m. He said, ich will bleiben a ganz am Aretz. It means I'm going to remain a big am Aretz. He's 92 years old. The whole world is turning to him for counsel and suck him. But in his mind, he was going to remain am Aretz if he could not learn as much as he wanted to. And in fact, the whole world did turn to him. I heard from a distinguished Rav, who was a mishmach of YU, who told me that the joke was, when you get your smicha, so on one side it would say, Yora, Yora, this person is ready to paskin shayla, Yodin, Yodin, he can rule in the Yora day, he can rule in Choshen Mishpat. On the other side it would say, Oregon 71212. I think I'm remembering the numbers right. In the old days, the phone number, they would give the first two numbers they'd give letters to. You know, like you have on the buttons on the phone. So Rav Moshe's phone number was OR71212. I think that I'm recalling correctly. So on the one hand, so yeah, we're ready to pass. On the other hand, I had Rav Moshe's phone number on the other side in case you come to a difficult shaila. And of course, there are many, many shailas that the young Rav is not ready to pass in, and people were turning to Rav Moshe constantly. Rav Moshe is known as a big makel, as a person who had the ability to present leniencies. As a matter of fact, as Rabbi Simkovich said before, Rav Moshe was considered by many to be one of the Posek Hador, one of the Poskei Hador. That was largely in America. in Eretz Yisrael, there were other leaders here from Israel, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and many others, and it has to be that way. A person can only paskin for the people where he lives. The nature of people is different. The nature of society is different. What works in the Israeli educational system maybe doesn't work in America. A posuk has to be uniquely trained to be thoroughly intact with the ethos, with the sentiment of the people where, for whom he's paskening. So usually you have it like that. There's a mora da'asa, there's a person who paskened for one location, and people who live somewhere else have a different posuk. You will find that there are many things where the minhag, the general practice, is to be more lenient in America than in Eretz Yisrael, because Rav Moshe was a most influential posek in America, and Rav Moshe had what we call a great koach dehetera. Koach dehetera means koach lahata, the ability to be lenient. Anybody can say it's usur. Anytime you ask a shaila, I can always say, no, you can't. That's very easy. It's pretty safe. What takes greater strength is to be able to say, no, it's permissible. It looks like it's not permissible, but it is, if you understand the sugya properly. Rav Moshe had great ability to be lenient. He had actually some radical leniencies, some of which caused significant commotion. As a matter of fact, if we could look in the sources, if you open up your booklets, I want to show you two tshuvos that are almost opposite. So you turn to page 3. It's not so much the substance of the tshuva, the halachic logic that I'm interested in these two tshuvas. It's the attitude, it's the personality you see. Take a look here on page 3, the first column. There's Simon Tzadi Vav, chapter 96 in the first volume of the Igros Moshe. So we have here, Bedvar Nesiel Anoshim Bekar. You know what a car is? It's a car. Okay? The matter of people traveling in a car, Acher Hadlokas Haneros, after candlelighting. It's Friday afternoon. It's after candlelighting time. The question is, can one travel in a car, the Beis HaMedrash, to the Beis HaMedrash, or to the Shul? Somuch Erech Shnei Minuten. That's just about 2 minutes away, l'chol hayoser at most. Is there a problem traveling in a car after candlelighting time if you're just going a short distance? Moshe lived at, what was it, 455 FDR Drive, and he's traveling to MTJ. It's a couple blocks away. Is there a problem going in the car after candlelighting time? Look what happens here. You know, when we have tshuvos, tshuva means a response. What we don't have is the she'ela. Somebody sent a letter or sometimes approached Rav Moshe in person and asked something, or sometimes said something, or demanded something, and Rav Moshe had to respond. So we don't have what the person sent to him, but you can very often figure out from the response the tone and the nature of the question. So he writes this letter to someone, I don't know who this is. He writes, Nehenesi ma'od. I had a lot of hana. I enjoy the fact that Sher Malas Kvoda, that Your Honor, Rav Moshe always addressed people with very dignified titles. I'm very happy. I got a lot of hana from the fact that you were quick to fulfill the mitzvah of giving rebuke. Rav Moshe is not being sarcastic. He's being very serious. I'm happy that you were quick to do the mitzvah of giving tochacha, lefi daito, according to your understanding. And I give thanks for my last kvodo. I thank you. Apparently, the letter writer must have said, I hope you won't be angry at me. I hope you won't be machted. So Moshe writes back, Chas v'shalom, I'm not upset. I'm going to come back to that in a second. Now let's see what he says. Moshe is trying to say there is no Isser Maris Ayin. Maris Ayin means when you do something that if someone were to see you doing it, he would think you're doing an Aveira, as we know. You know, they tell the famous story of the Chafetz Chaim, that the Chafetz Chaim was once traveling in a train, and there's a Jew sitting next to him. It's an old story that the Jew sitting next to him didn't realize he was sitting next to the Chafetz Chaim. So the Jew said, you know, I'm going to see the Chafetz Chaim. So the Chafetz Chaim responded, yeah, he's such a great tzaddik. So the Chafetz Chaim felt uncomfortable. So he said, Yeah, I mean, he's okay. He's just okay. One version of the story gave him a slap, and the other version of the story he yelled at him. And then, of course, when they arrived at the place and all the Jews who were there converged on the Chavetz Chaim, this Jew felt terrible. I once said that Rav Soloveitchik said he didn't believe that the story was true because the Chavetz Chaim would have been in violation of Maris Ayin. To say, if a Jew doesn't know that you are the Chavetz Chaim, you say about the Chavetz Chaim, he's not such a great guy. That's Lashon Hara. You don't speak Lashon Hara about the Chavetz Chaim. That's a big no-no. So Rav Soloveitchik said he didn't believe that story was true. It was probably embellished or created to teach a lesson. So Maris Ayin is when it looks like you're doing something that's wrong. So Rav Moshe says, Ki yeda yedidi, you should know, my friend, that Shirisa Maris Ayin, who rock bedavar shenese ze berova pama ba'ofana aser. Maris Ayin is normally somebody doing what you're doing would be doing something wrong. You happen to be doing something right. Classic example in Yeridea, they used to make sort of a non-dairy milk, a non-dairy cream out of almonds, like we have today, tofu and other things. So the halacha said that you had to keep, if you were going to put that into meat, you had to keep the almonds out on the table so nobody should think you're cooking meat and milk together. Because most of the times, today it might not be so because we have so many substitutes, but at least in olden times, most of the time if you saw meat and you saw cream, that cream was milk. So if you happen to be using a unique product that's not milk, you had to show people that it's not milk. That's Maris Ayin. Okay? Kigon Lassus Ayideakum Bekablonis, he gives a different example. You're not allowed to ask a non-Jew to do work for you on Shabbos. If you hired him to do a task, and you didn't tell him when to do it, he can do it for you. If you told him, work today, I'll pay you to work on Saturday, that's usser. If you tell him, I just want you to get this job done, I want you to fix my car, and he happens to fix it on Shabbos, but you didn't tell him to, that's really permissible. That's what's called kablonis. It's contract work, not what we call per diem work. However, the halacha says, if you study the third volume of Mishnah Berurah at the beginning, if you do something where most people would be paying per day, and you happen to have contracted the worker, so to the onlooker, it looks like you told them to work on Shabbos. You didn't. You told them just do the job whenever you want. But since it looks like you told them to do it on Shabbos, it looks like you're doing something else. So he gives that as an example. Let's skip down a little bit. It's Maris Ayin because most people would be doing something wrong. You happen to be doing it in a way that's permissible. You're not allowed to do that. He says, similarly, if your clothing got wet on Shabbos, you're not supposed to hang it on a clothesline or someplace that's designated for drying clothes. Usually when people hang clothes on a clothesline, it's because they washed it. You didn't wash it, you just walked through the rain, or you fell in a puddle. But most people will assume that they see you hanging up your clothes on a clothesline that you washed it on Shabbos, so it's Maris Ayin. Okay. However, if you skip down, he says, "Uvdazu she yadua lakol shenoshi mekabel Shabbos by lakas aneris." Everybody knows women accept Shabbos when they light candles. "Vanoshi mekabel Shabbos b'tosefes katan." Usually, we light candles 18 minutes or 20 minutes before Shabbos, but you don't have to accept Shabbos that early. The one who lights, the woman usually accepts Shabbos. That's the minhag. But men don't accept Shabbos till a couple minutes before Shkia, which is it could be 15 minutes later. We light 20 minutes before, okay? So he goes on, if you look at the truth, he goes on to give you the exact numbers. One of the things I said about Rav Moshe is he was very, very conscious of numbers. In his biography, they have the exact dates when different events happened, pogroms, good things, bad things. He always remembered dates. Rav Moshe remembers numbers perfectly. As a matter of fact, I remember once hearing a story that he was giving a shiur in Halacha, and he said, the Magen Avraham says in Siskotin Yud Gimel that it's okay. And somebody called the Rebbe, it's Siskotin Tesvav. And he got very nervous. And he flipped over the shulchan and he said, no, I'm right. It's Siskotin Yud Gimel. And he explained, he said, I paskin a shaila with the assumption that I remember everything. And when you told me that I made a mistake, I got nervous and I'm starting to forget things. So thank God I checked out, you're wrong and I'm right. So I'm still okay. But Rav Moshe was very cognizant of numbers. His family reports that he could look at a tall building, like with a cursory glance, and he would be able to tell you how many windows and how many floors there are. He was very, very good with numbers. So here he happens to write out, he said, the Shabbos that you saw me get in the car, candle lighting was 4:32. I'm sorry, Shkia was 4:32. I got in the car at 4:19. He gives you the exact details. There was still like a good number of minutes to get to shul before Shabbos, and it's only a short ride. So he says, therefore, what I did was not Maris Ayin. And he says, even if a few people don't understand the halacha, if there are a few people who think that once candle lighting happens, no one's allowed to do malacha, not even a man who didn't light the candles, Maris Ayin doesn't apply for a few people who are misunderstanding the halacha. Maris Ayin is where most people who understand halacha would think it's incorrect. But look at that second to last paragraph. After explaining why he's right, and mind you, this tshuva was written in the 1950s. Okay, Rav Moshe lived till 1986. Avol mikol makom, the second to bottom paragraph. However, kevin shemalas kvodo kosev, since you write, sheyesh chas v'shalom kilkul le'ezu nashim v'anashim sheyidama sheyesh b'zeh zilzal Shabbos Kodesh, since you told me, this guy who started off with Rav Moshe said, how'd you get in the car after candlelighting? Since you told me that some people, you know, think it's Chilul Shabbos because of that they won't keep Shabbos properly. I'll never travel in a car after candlelighting time again. So in the freezing cold, slushy days, Rav Moshe Feinstein, for probably the next 30 years of his life, had to walk to shul every Friday night. We know how rushed we usually are Friday afternoon. Usually people are running late and they could use those extra couple minutes. But he accepted for the rest of his life, even though halakhically what he did is perfectly permissible, but since you say it's confusing to people, I won't do it anymore. Fascinating. Anivus. Halakhically I'm correct, but it's a posuk has to see beyond the strict halakha. The tremendous anivus. Most people would say, how dare you start up with me? You're not Ma'aretz, it's not Ma'aretzayan, get out of my life and close the book. But Rav Moshe, if you felt, you tell me it's going to be confusing to people, I won't do it anymore. Contrast that to the next page. This is a tshuva in Eben HaEzer. This tshuva is on a subject which caused one of the biggest commotions and actually caused Rav Moshe a lot of agnes nefesh, a lot of anguish. Rav Moshe had a psak. The particulars of the psak are not relevant to us. It had to do with fertility technologies and a child born where the genetic material was procured in different ways, where basically Satmar Hasidim and some other groups felt this was a terrible, to permit this or to say that this child is not a mamzer was a terrible churban. It was going to destroy the Kedusha of Klal Yisrael. And Rav Moshe felt strongly, there's nothing wrong. He actually didn't advise the practice, but he held you can't say anything of this child's yichus. The particulars of the shaila are not as relevant to us, but I want you to see how he writes. Look at Siman Yud Aleph. It's on the next page in your booklet there. So he writes to this person, Hinei kibalti mechtavo, I received your letter. Ha'aruch ma'od, very long-winded. Hamale divrei tochacha al kol gadosav, that's overflowing. Al kol gadosav means it's spilling over with rebuke. Al-mashal afidaito nidma lo shetshuvasis, it seems to you that what I wrote elsewhere, Yigrimu eza pirta b'taharas ikdushas yichus klal Yisrael. You feel very strongly that my ruling, my lenient ruling, is going to destroy the sanctity of Jewish families. It seems very clear from your letter that you thought that I would be angry, that I would have a kapeda, I would be upset that you wrote to me. Vani adarava, he said, to the contrary. Ani nirgash miza, I'm moved by this. Shani roa shenim tzoyim anashim bali ruach, that there are people who have backbone. She'enam yireyim b'lo misbayshim b'lomar tachacha. I am inspired that there are people who are willing to give rebuke. Aval ha'emes, but I'll tell you the truth. First of all, my psak is not going to cause any problems. El Torah's emes nidiv rabbeinu rishonim. It's 100% correct. The error shall quote Tarasa al zeh. Now listen to what he says. This is amazing. He says, "You think we have to be machmir, and I'm being makel. You know where your attitude comes from." Your attitude comes from elsewhere. It's not from the Torah. Your chumrah, it's from outer space. And that can even affect people who are very learned. He's saying, you're taking some outside hashkafa, some outside perspective, and forcing it into the Torah. So usually we say that when we're being machmir and the other person's being makel. Hey, you're introducing new ideas to the Torah. We have to be machmir. We can't let that in. The Moshe is doing the opposite. He's saying, you hold we have to be machmir, and I'm telling you, no, we don't. And your hashkafa is coming from the wrong place. When you bring in foreign ideas that don't come from the Torah and you force it into the Torah, you say the things that are mutter are really aser, and vice versa. Okay, it's an amazing thing that Rav Moshe felt my leniency is correct, and you who are mean to be machmir, you're getting your ideas from elsewhere. My hashkafos come solely from the Torah. My view of this matter is based solely on the Torah, not from other sentiments. Amazing the confidence with which Rav Moshe responds to this writer. I want to show you in the introduction to the Igros Moshe. Sometimes the introduction to a sefer, that's the first page. Sometimes the introduction to a sefer is a nice tzar Torah, a nice drush. Rav Moshe's introduction to the Igros Moshe, to his great work, which is where you find all of his psukim, is something that he refers to repeatedly in his tshuvos. It is where he explains why he has the license to paskin. What gives me the right to rule on a shaila? So I'm not going to read through all of it, but just to give you the idea of it, on page 1, this is the Hakdama, this is the introduction to the very first volume of the Igros Moshe. He writes, Hine sifri ze sheruva hu masha yishavti masha yinir lan yisdek loris halacha l'maisa. This sefer, these are real letters. There's some tshuvas form, by the way, some books of responsa that are not real letters. If you ever study the Trumas Hadeshin, Trumas Hadeshin is one of the great Rishonim, and it's a book of She'elos Tshuvas, questions and answers. But as a matter of fact, Hadeshin is 354. There are, coincidentally, 354 Tshuvas in the Trumas Hadeshin, but he made up the questions, right? Sometimes if you want to, it's a good pedagogical tool, if you want to teach people, so you ask a question, what is our aim today? What are we going to do? And you answer the question. So he would ask a question and give an answer, but they weren't questions that were sent to him. As a matter of fact, there's a place in Shulchan Aruch where one of the poskim writes, he says, even though from the question in the Trumas Hadeshin it sounds like this, but from his answer you see that it's like that. So someone else writes back, you're making a mistake because he wrote the question too. So sometimes person writing the tshuvos wrote the she'elos as well. But not so with Rav Moshe. These were real questions that were submitted to him over the course of numerous decades. We have tshuvos that date back from back when he was in Russia, letters he wrote to his brother, who unfortunately was later killed, and other questions from his early years in Rabbanus, and we have many from later years in America. By the way, I want to mention in Luban, when they were in Russia, there was a change in regime, and the new regime wanted to modernize society. They were very anti-religious, and they wanted to update the mode of the times. And the Jews, until that point, had had a mikveh in town. They had immediately closed the mikveh. They felt anything that was ritual, a ritual bath, has no place in the modernized, the sophisticated mind. And they also took the bathhouse, and believe it or not, they were going to make, there were no separate hours for men and women. They felt this was progressive. So Rav Moshe, this was two terrible tragedies at once. So Rav Moshe Feinstein came to the authorities, and he was well respected. By the way, even after Rav Moshe left Russia, he found out that his svarim were in the libraries. The Russians were proud that they had a great Ravinam, a Rav. Who was a scholar, even if they hated Jews. But in any event, Rav Moshe came to the authorities, and he took the lesson of Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu in Mitzrayim came to Paro and said, you're working the Jews 7 days a week. No one can work 7 days a week. It's what they call in economics the law of diminishing returns. When you work someone too hard, and maybe I don't want to come between the administration and the students on this one, but when you work someone too hard, so they stop working. We need some vacation, we need some break, and then you get better results. So, right, so Moshe Rabbeinu convinced Paro to give him a day off, and he made that day off Shabbos. So Rav Moshe did the same thing over here. He said, you may be right. Your view of the world may be correct, but if you do that to the Jews, first of all, they're not going to bathe. And if they don't bathe, there's going to be disease, and it's going to cause all kinds of problems. So he says, do me a favor. make separate hours just as the Jews. You're right. Your hashkafa is correct. I'm not starting up with you on a philosophical grounds, but I know the Jews. They're stubborn people. They're an amk sheyorov. They're not going to do it. So give them separate hours so that they'll bathe. Then when that request was granted, he had a technician go in and adjust the system of the plumbing in the bathhouse. And he has a tshuva about this, and this is a topic in Hilchos Mikvaos, something called tshuvim b'amshacha, the way the water flowed into the pool. He made it that it was a minimally kosher mikvah. It's not something we would do l'chachila, but there was no other option. So Moshe made a minimally kosher mikvah for the townspeople. His family personally didn't rely on it, but he told everyone else that they must. So Moshe knew how to respond to difficult circumstances. He knew how to respond to communist Russia, and he knew how to respond to a more hedonistic, if you will, America, and he understood the nature of people. So he writes in the introduction here, he says, what gives me the right to Paskin Shilas? Okay, he says, these are things that I actually responded. These are letters that I wrote to people who asked my opinion. What gives me the right to do so? Second line, he says, V'af shemin haroi hayelachar l'minoam ilahashif. Even though it really would be appropriate to refrain from responding. Rav Moshe, with all of his knowledge, he could tell you Shulchan Aruch backwards and forwards, he had a working knowledge of every topic and shas, he still felt, really, I shouldn't paskin. Really, who am I to offer a halachic ruling? Sherei harbe gedoli olam b'torah v'yiras Hashem nimnu milharos. Many great gedoli Yisrael refrained from paskining a shayla. Chazal say negative things about a person who's gas libo b'hara. He's quick to paskin. Oh, you got a shayla? Here, I'll answer. I know the answer. Chazal say have a mesunim badin. You have to consider things very, very carefully and thoroughly. And that's what the Gemara says. The Gemara in Sota, Mimama Rabbi Abba Rav Huna Marav, the Gemara in Sota Chabez, Rabim Chalolim Hepila. There's a pasuk in the seventh parak of Mishlei. It talks about a wayward woman as a metaphor for like being misled. So it says Rabim Chalolim Hepila. She's caused many casualties. Chazal say, what does that refer to? Zeh Talmid Chacham Shelo Higia LaHara Umore. This is a Talmid Chacham, not an Amoritz, a learned person. But he's not yet qualified to rule on a question, and he does nonetheless. Right? Like they say in English, a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing. If I know a little bit, I think I got the whole picture. The more you learn, the more you realize you're only seeing the tip of the iceberg. So if a person is a Talmud Chacham, he's learned, but he doesn't yet know enough that he should be ruling. That's Rabim Chalolim Apila, causes casualties. So says Rav Moshe, Afsham Agam Vatzumim Kol Haruga. The rest of the pasuk is the opposite. The second half of the pasuk says, and great are the slain, Zet Talmud Chacham Sheigil Oro Ve'Eino Mora. That's the Talmud Chacham who really is fit to paskin, and he refrains from doing so. So we have a double-edged sword. On the one hand, if I'm not fit to paskin a shayla, and I do, it causes casualties. So maybe I'll err on the side of caution. All right, so I won't get involved in that. But it says, but if you're fit to paskin a shayla, if you're Higil Oro, and you don't, that also causes casualties. So true, it does say that, but Rav Moshe basically says, but how can we really be sure that we're Higia L'Hara? He says a person has to really understand the Torah intimately to be ready to rule on a halakha question. He said, can anyone today really be sure that they're up to par with Chassam Sofer and Rav Kiva Eger and go back to the generation of the Rishonim? But he goes on to say basically that he believes that if a person studies the Torah thoroughly, and does so with Yiras Shamayim and Davens. Paskening correctly requires not only intellectual effort, it requires spiritual effort. It requires you have to daven at achonin l'adam das. But if one has done all of that, and he's put in his best effort, and he's worked things out fully, and this is what he believes the halacha is, but Moshe says, I believe that it is one's responsibility to pasken. The Gemara in Brachos, he quotes it, says that David HaMelech was willing to sort of defile himself to deal with all kinds of mundane questions. So Rav Moshe says, what? He was the king, David Melech Yisrael. There were many other Talmidei Chachamim, right? Chazal tell us of all the other Chachamim whom David HaMelech learned from, and you see them in the Ishei HaTanach. He's the king, let him send it to someone else. It's beneath the king's dignity. Rav Moshe says it must be that if a person comes to a posek with a shayla, if the posek is qualified to answer the question, he's not allowed to send the person on. He has to rule. That's what you see from David HaMelech. Otherwise, why should the king do it? If they came to him and say, you know, go to the other guy, go somewhere else. So the fact that David HaMelech paskin means it's a responsibility. And Rav Moshe says a little bit of a drush. The famous Gemara it says that Moshe Rabbeinu was given a vision into the future, and he saw HaKadosh Baruch Hu putting crowns on the letters of the Torah. Right, we know the letters Shatnez Getz, Shin, Ayin, Tesnun, Zion, Gimel, and Tzadi have Tagin, have crowns in the Torah. That's a halacha. But Moshe Rabbeinu was shown a vision of HaKadosh Baruch Hu tying crowns, putting little crowns on the Torah, on the letters of the Torah. And he said, God, mi ma'akev al yadcha, who's holding you back? And HaKadosh Baruch Hu responded, there's somebody in the future named Akiva, who is going to darshan tilei tilin shel halachas, who's going to derive all kinds of nuances in halacha from those little crowns, those little tagin on the letters. That's a gemara, it's a gemara menachos. It's a difficult gemara to understand. What does that mean? Who's holding you back? And why are they called crowns? Says Rav Moshe, you know what the gemara means? It means that really, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when giving the Torah, there's what we call a ratzon hamuchlat. What does the Torah mean? What is the halacha? There's so many matters in halacha where it's a debate. Rambam holds yes, Rajba holds no. Rav Moshe Feinstein holds yes, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach holds no. Right? To say, what's the truth? How was the Torah given? It could well be that the Torah was given with a certain truth. HaKadosh Baruch Hu Kilayachu meant it a certain way. But the halacha is, as we say, lo bashamayim, the Torah is meant to be interpreted by people, not by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was putting crowns on the letters, meaning he was declaring the letters to be the king. Not him. The Melech Malchei Melechim is not the king. From the day that God gave over the Torah, the letters of the Torah are the king. The way the letters are understood by mankind, by the Sanhedrin, by Jews who dedicate their lives to understanding the Torah and teaching the Torah, that is the halacha. If Rav Moshe paskened it's mutter, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu paskened it's usher, it's mutter. Because the Torah was given to be paskened by the Gedolei Yisrael. We have examples of that in the Gemara. There's a Gemara where after Psak Halacha, they found Eliyahu Navi, and they said to Eliyahu Navi, what's HaKadosh Baruch Hu doing now? And he's saying, Nitzchuni b'nei, you beat me. Meaning HaKadosh Baruch Hu held this way, and the Halacha is the other way. The Torah is meant to be understood the way the Chachamim understood it. So Rav Moshe held, the Torah itself teaches us that one is supposed to work at it, come to an understanding, and then paskin the Halacha. And Rav Moshe had very, very broad shoulders in doing so. I'm hoping in a couple of weeks on Shavuos to give a shiur on what I think is an interesting halachic topic. A person who goes to save a life on Shabbos, a medical doctor, or a volunteer from the ambulance corps, or a Hatzalah member in communities where they have Hatzalah, there's a Jewish volunteer group. So, the question of returning on Shabbos. Okay, a person drove his car to save a life. Everything, we override everything to save a life. Shabbos is overridden. He's allowed to do any malacha necessary. And then he finished. Either he saved a life, or maybe the person ended up being okay, whatever the circumstance. Now he's 10 miles from home. Can he go home? What would you say is the halacha? Anybody want to paskin? Yeah, what do you say? Mr. Ekman. Rabbi Ekman. Al Shem HaAsid. Rav Moshe used to give people honorary titles for what they would be. So that's what we're doing. Yes. Right, I mean that would seem to be the simple logic that when a person's life was in danger, you're allowed to rush over there and do whatever you have to do. But now there's no more danger to life, no more issue of pikuach nefesh. You can't drive back. That would seem to be pretty straightforward. What do you say? Son of a doctor, yeah.
If the guy knows he's not going to be able to get back,
Okay, good. Somebody else? And you're going to say something?
I think Rabbi Kuberman had mentioned earlier this year, it was actually Sarah, I don't know where he saw this from, but he said, since the doctor gave him anything he needs to get home, because otherwise he wouldn't go in the first place.
Okay, right. This is a concept called Hitiru Sofon Mishum Tchilosan. We allow the end because of the beginning. In other words, we allow you to come back because we're afraid if we won't let you come back, you won't go. So we allow the end to motivate the beginning. However, we can sit here. This is what we call armchair philosophy. What do you think it should be? We're not, of course, looking in the Gemara, looking in the Rishonim, looking in the Poskim. I'm not a betting man, but I'm willing to bet. I would probably put down significant money if I were a betting man, that if all of you, each one of you in this room, would take out a Gemara Erevin and study Mem Dalet Amud Beis and Mem Hei Amud Aleph, which is a sugya relevant, talks about Yatzu Lahatzil, somebody who went out to save. If you study that sugya, I'm willing to bet you would reach the conclusion that a person who went on a life-saving mission is allowed to violate an Isser Derabbanan, a rabbinic prohibition on his return, but not an Isser D'Oraisa. I think that is certainly the Pashtus HaGemara, the simple reading of the Gemara. It seems pretty straightforward. It seems that way pretty much from Shulchan Aruch. I'm willing to bet that if you looked at that Gemara, that's the conclusion you would reach. And in fact, many posts can reach that conclusion. In Eretz Yisrael, I believe the accepted psak is, and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach held this way, that a person can return only if that's how he makes himself available for an expected next emergency. In other words, there's an ambulance and it goes far out to the stick somewhere to save someone and has to be back in town because every Shabbos there's a few emergencies, so we need to have the equipment on hand to save the next life, which we can anticipate based on statistics that there's been a subsequent emergency every Shabbos. If you go, you better come back because you're facilitating saving the next life. But short of that circumstance, if he's just a single doctor who happens to have been called somewhere but doesn't anticipate that he would be called again, the simple reading of the Gemara and the Poskim would sound like, I believe very much so, that you can do an Issa D'Rabbanan, you can ask a non-Jew to drive you back, you could violate another Issa D'Rabbanan, but not an Issa D'Oraisa. It seems very clear from the Gemara. But Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva, and he held very, very strongly that a person who has gone on a life-saving mission on Shabbos may and must return. Because of the start, two of you just mentioned, we call Hitiru Sofon Mishum Tchivasan. We're afraid you won't go if you don't return. Yeah, what do you say?
Well, does that include all forms of Derabbanan? Theoretically, if you've got cell vacations, can you go to a car and
I can't get too much into Halacha L'maisa here. You'll have to ask... And nothing I say here is a psak halacha. One should ask your LOR, as they say in. It would seem to be any derabbanan. But Rav Moshe held even an Issa D'Oraisa. Rav Moshe held you can turn on the car, ignite any Issa D'Oraisa, do whatever has to be done to come home, and he held that you have to do that. The svara we can relate to. We can relate to the logic of it. A way to save lives is to ensure that people can save lives. If you have doctors. Who it happens every couple of months that in the middle of the Shabbos meal, or let's say Friday night, they get called away and they have to go somewhere, and then his wife and the family will not see him for the rest of, or his husband and family won't see him for the rest of Shabbos. People are going to say, I don't want you going into that field. I want you to do something else, and then we will have lives that won't be saved. So the logic of it, we can certainly relate to Hitir Sofa Mishim Tchilasim, but we need a source in the Gemara. Rav Moshe, based on a difficulty in a Tosos and a certain way of reading a Rajba, basically whenever you learn Gemara, there's a simple way of understanding things, but then there's a few outstanding questions. I don't quite understand this, I don't quite understand that. Rav Moshe sees in those few questions that there's a whole other piece to the sugya. There's like an unspoken, but what he holds is an obvious unspoken reality, and holds based on that, the halacha is that you must come back. And that basically is the accepted shock in America based on Rav Moshe's ruling. It is not poshut. It is not a simple matter. And Rav Moshe had the broad shoulders. Not only did he say they can, but he held they must. He was insistent, and Rav Moshe was very forceful in Hatzolah, which you have in the New York area and other areas of large concentrations of Jews where you want to have quicker rescue time. Many lives have been saved because of these volunteers. Rav Moshe paskin that they should come back. They must come back. A Rebbe of mine was at a meeting at which there were some other Rabbanim who didn't agree with that psak. And another Rebbe, a Hasidish Rebbe, said, I can't have my people join Hatzolah because I can't take the Chil Shabbos. And another Rebbe, the Bessina Rebbe, banged on the table, he said, I'm sorry, you can disagree with Rav Moshe, but if Rav Moshe said, this is the halacha, you can't call it Chil Shabbos. Rav Moshe, post the Kandor, you can't call it that. So Rav Moshe had the what we call the plates in Yiddish, it means the broad shoulders to, based on his own logic, his own understanding of Shas, to make significant statements. Rav Moshe had a famous disagreement with Rav Henkin, whether a marriage that was performed without any valid siddur kiddushin, whether that's considered a valid marriage, that if a woman subsequently remarried, that considered is the second marriage invalid, which has obviously significant ramifications. Rav Moshe was lenient on this question. Rav Henkin felt very, very, very strongly. Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, who was another one of the Gedolei Yisrael, felt very strongly the opposite way. Rav Moshe advised people always lechachila to follow Rav Henkin's position, but he held strongly that he was correct. Rav Moshe was not afraid to take on others. Rav Moshe was unique in other ways, and these are perhaps the things that we cannot so readily aspire to. One of the things that people who visited Rav Moshe observed, particularly in this season, the spring and the summer, is that bugs would not go near him. I heard from somebody who once visited Rav Moshe on a spring day outside, and the Rebbetzin brought out iced tea or lemonade or something, and they were sitting there, and this visitor said that in his iced tea, it was like a burial ground for gnats. The flies were falling into it, and Rav Moshe's, they wouldn't go, bugs did not go near him. And his grandchildren record that he was even aware of this. You know, if you learn, say, from Malachim, the Isha Shunamis, that Hine Isha Lokim over Aleinu Tamid, this man of God visits us. The Gemara in Brachas says, how did she know that he was a man of God? Because she saw that bugs don't go near him. It's an indication of greatness. It could, in fact, be explained, by the way, in Parshas Noach, after the Mabul, the fear of man is placed upon the animals. But it never says, I think the Vilna Gaon points this out, it never says that the fear of man was put upon Sheretz Ha'of. Sheretz Ha'of means flying insects, which is why most creatures are afraid of people. They don't go near you. The squirrel sees a person and runs away. But bugs are willing to go right up to you. The Vilna Gaon explained this phenomenon, he said, because after the Mabul, after the flood, humanity was lowered a level. Because of the sins that led to it, humanity was lowered. So certain creatures don't fear us. So he explained that a person who has the status of Kodam Hamabul, is on that lofty status of humanity before the flood, a higher level of humanity, so even insects have a certain fear of him. So this could be perhaps, but Rav Moshe was aware of this. He once, like, sheepishly said, yeah, I was zochet to a certain swift that bugs don't go near me. Rav Moshe had a dichotomy of being very hard on himself and very easy on others. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky has a brilliant insight, a beautiful insight, at the beginning of Parshas Vayera. He says, look at Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu is the paradigm Baal Chesed. He's sitting outside, it's 110 degrees in the shade, and he's longing for guests. Right? He's upset that there are no guests there. God took the sun and made it very hot so guests shouldn't bother him, but he wants guests. This is a man who longs to do Chesed. What's the very next scene? Scene 2, Parshas Vayera. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you know, Avram, there's these people in Sodom, they hate Chesed. They hate helping others. Now, normally, when you excel at something, you're naturally critical of others who don't. You ever try to work on a computer with somebody who's very good at computers? No, it drives you crazy. Usually, when you're very good at something, you can't bear it that others don't excel in that area. You would expect, here's Avram Avinu, who's worked on himself so much to be a Baal Chesed, and God comes to him and says, you know, there's a people who are anti-chesed. They don't do chesed at all. They outlaw chesed. What should Avraham Avinu say? Ooh, eliminate them. We can't have that. What kind of terrible people? Look at me. Right? Usually we look down on people who don't excel in an area where we do. But Avraham Avinu leaps up. Maybe there's 50 tzaddikim, 45, 40, 30, 20. He's begging for mercy. All right, don't be so harsh on them. They don't do chesed. They don't know better. Despite his greatness, he didn't look down on others who didn't have it. Rav Moshe Feinstein very much embodied that midah. Despite how hard he worked on himself and his excellence in Torah, he was machazik. He gave strength to anyone who had made even small strides. Many people would come with a newly published sefer, a book, something. Rav Moshe, oh, this is wonderful, this is great. He would give a haskama, an approbation. It's so nice. If he wanted to, he could tear it apart. This is wrong, that's wrong, this is wrong. You missed an open gemara, you don't understand the pasuk. He could tear it to shreds. But he was pleased to see people working and excelling. That's a great balance that you don't find so often between being very hard on oneself and very accepting of others. And that's something that we can learn from as well. He was very normal, despite the fact that he worked hard on himself. When you spoke to him, it was as if he had all the time in the world. He accepted people to save upon him yafos. These are great midos. But I just conclude, I think if there's one thing particularly that we can take away, that we can draw from Rav Moshe, as I said before, it's a life of building. Every experience was stored. I learned a lesson from this. I learned a lesson from that. When you study Torah, whatever you study, you should reserve it in your mind. Write it down in your notes. Try to remember it. If you forget it, look back. This is how I understand the halacha. This is how I understand this parsha. This is how I understand this section of the Navi. Whatever it may be. But the same is true for what we call mili d'alma, matters in life. How do you deal with a hard situation? Here's an awkward social situation. What should I do? You think about it. You reach a conclusion. I tried it. It failed. Got in big trouble. I reserve for next time. Next time that happens, I'm going to do it a different way. He learns from every single experience. From reading the word Itmar as Itamar, he learned something that he told over 90 years later. We can all do that. Too often we just, you know, especially when you're in school and you get graded, so ultimately the goal is to get the grade, and somehow I'm guilty of the same thing, that once the test is passed, there's a valve in the brain that sort of lets it go. It shouldn't be that way. Everything we learn, we should seek to hold on to. It's one brick after the other. Sometimes you get a big brick, sometimes you get a small one, sometimes it's just a little decoration. But it all goes into building the binyan, the building, the great structure, which is yourself, which is your neshama. And that's something we can take from Rav Moshe Feinstein. We perhaps can't be as great scholars as he was, but we can learn from that and take from every opportunity of life. And the truth is, you never know. I was once sitting in the car with my Rosh Hashiva, Rav Zelig Epstein, and I said to him, you know, we're always told that we have hiskadnus hadoros. We're smaller. They used to be greater, and we're getting smaller, which is largely true. And you get the impression it's an irreversible trend. So I asked him, I said, you know, Rebbe, why is it? You know, we've developed yeshivas since the Holocaust, thank God, we've turned around and rebuilt. You know, why is it that we can't be the way it once was? And you know, he said, give it time. He said, it took a long time for the European yeshivas to develop into what they were. Then I asked him, I said, do you think we'll ever make another person like the Chassam Sofer? And he laughed. But that doesn't mean that we can't develop further. Each of us probably has opportunities that our parents didn't have. I had opportunity to study more Torah than my father did. Not because I'm greater than him. His parents made certain sacrifices. His parents were Russian immigrants and made certain sacrifices. I have more opportunity. We should take advantage of that opportunity. We are burgeoning and developing. And if we keep in mind to take every moment of life, everything you learn in a sefer, everything you learn from a teacher, from a Rebbe, and just from life and life circumstances, if that's a brick that you put into the building, you keep it with you and you remember it, you'll be surprised with the passage of time. You will become great people, continue to be great people, and become even greater people. And that's something we can learn from the life of Rav Moshe Feinstein. I thank you very much.